Hi, I'm glad you're joining us for another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smulders. With me is Laurie Harrison, and she will introduce our guest for today.
Yes, and our guest today is Nancy McCoy, longtime island resident and keeper of many intriguing island stories. So, Nancy, our first question to everybody is, how in the heck did you get here?
Well, I grew up not knowing nothing about the San Juans. I didn't even realize they existed. Our family had a beach cottage at Birch Bay since the 1920s, and when we had some time off, we went to the cottage, or we called it the cabin. Grew up in the north end of Seattle shoreline, and lived there until my senior year of high school, and went away to college. And just after university at Seattle Pacific, a friend invited me over for an overnight at Orcas. He was working as a maitre d' at Rosario. Okay. And there were about seven guests, house guests. We had so much fun. We stayed a week. We overstayed our welcome, I think. We stayed a week during a northeastern. Oh. It was freezing cold. It was a house with just a wood cook stove and an open fireplace for heat. And within a year, four of the seven guests had moved up to Lopez Island in separate accommodations.
Fascinating, because you were on Orcas.
Mm-hmm. And we all ended up on Lopez.
You know why?
Sometimes I wonder about that myself. You know, I look over at Orcas or visit Orcas, and I think, that has a lot to offer. But for some reason at that time, Lopez pulled me, and I ended up coming to Lopez.
Are the others still here?
Mm-hmm.
Are you willing to divulge their names?
Alberta Franco, Becky, and Daryl Johnson. We all went to Seattle Pacific about the same time.
Wow.
Fascinating.
So I had the opportunity to house sit for 2 months for Alberta when she was going off traveling. And so a close friend and myself, Faith, and myself moved up for a two-month period to house sit. And at the end of that time, we were leaning, you know, thinking about staying, but we really didn't have any place to move to. And so Greg Blomberg spoke up and said, well, Nancy, Stanley Greenthal and Susan Bill just got married, and they're going to Europe for 6 months. I'm sure they wouldn't mind you moving into their house. I didn't know Stanley or Susan at all. Neither of us did. But we were desperate. We were young, naive. And so without even contacting Stanley or Susan, we moved into their house.
They and were gone? And
they were in Europe already.
Oh, boy, that's a new twist on the Lopez connection.
Yeah. And fortunately, we are in speaking terms, you know, even after all that. But so we lived there until planted a spring garden for them. So when they came back, they had a garden already started. And then from there, I found out about Steve Young's house, the old Ben Corman place, which is just beyond Pavey Boulevard on Snowberry Lane. It's a 100-year-old house, uninsulated. And at the time, Ben Corman was married to one of the Brown girls, one of the very early families on the island. And Steve Young was an English professor down at the Pomona College in the L.A. area, Pasadena. And this house was available 9 months out of the year. And because he would come up during the summer during his summer break. And so that was kind of a drawback for most. But I was desperate again, and so, and then the rent was good, too. He charged $1 a day rent. Plus, I had to take care of the chickens, feed them, plant their spring garden so that there was a garden waiting for them when they arrived.
Nancy, can you place us in time? What year was this?
This was mid-70s.
Okay, $1 a day.
Mm-hmm.
My, oh, my.
Yeah. But then I wasn't making much. I was just starting to volunteer at the museum about the time I moved in there, and they were paying me $100 a month. So, you know, that was about a third of my income, monthly income at that time. The house had wood heat, a really crummy old, I think, Navy surplus stove. I finally wised up after a while and bought my own stove, and as soon as I would move in, I would enlist two other women, and we'd move his stove out to the entry porch, and I had a small little yodel stove I called a three-woman stove, and we would move my stove in and hook it up, and it was much warmer. It had an outhouse, just a cold water tap.
Oh.
And so it was pretty rugged.
Mm-hmm. Lopez rustic.
Yeah, Lopez rustic. And he usually came home. He'd usually send a letter and say, I'll be there on June 7th. So I'd be all packed up, and my possessions would be in storage somewhere. And oftentimes I wouldn't have a place to move into for the summer. And so I would, on many occasion, I rented it for 7 years. And so on many occasion, he had given me the date of arrival, and I would cruise by the house a little bit after the last ferry arrival time. And if there were no lights on in the house, I would pull back into the driveway, go back into the house, throw my sleeping bag on the bed, and have one more night under shelter.
Oh, God.
And then what happened?
Oftentimes I'd rely on friends or throw my sleeping bag out in the bushes somewhere. I have to tell one story about the house. In my years working at the museum, I've met a lot of people that had lived on the island in previous years or had worked on the island. And one of those was a school teacher of the Mud Bay School. She taught in the early 1900s. Her name was Nan Scanlon. And she rented that house when it belonged to Ben Corman and his wife, one of the brown girls. Mariah was her name, Mariah Corman. And she rented the... There were two rooms upstairs, and she rented the two rooms upstairs, and at that time the main floor was divided into several rooms, so the Cormans lived downstairs on the main floor. You had to go through their house, I believe, to get upstairs. It was an interior stairway. Well, she told me the story of how the Cormans basically stayed at home. But one time, for some reason, Mrs. Corman had to go to the mainland for several days. And so she decided to stay there anyway, just with Mr. Corman downstairs. Well, she was settled upstairs in her room one night, and she heard this clomp, clomp, clomp coming up the stairs. And she was just sort of pulled her sheets up or her blankets up, you know, and was kind of nervous and scared. And then the steps stopped at the landing and paused for what seemed like forever, and then finally she heard him turn around and go back down the stairs.
He realized there was somebody there.
No, he knew she was living up there. He was going to visit her.
But he thought better of his plan.
Yeah, he changed his mind.
Nice.
Decided that, no, he wouldn't do that.
Okay.
Now, I had a similar thing happen to me in that house one night. Years later, I was living alone there. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and there was some person, a man, who I had just been introduced to that day and had made no suggestion of getting together or anything like that. Anyway, I woke up in the middle of the night and this guy was sitting on the edge of my bed upstairs. He had come up, walked into my house. At that time, we didn't lock our doors. So it was sort of a similar story. I did some
It was the house.
Maybe. I did some fast talking and he left. And I never saw him again.
My, oh my.
So that was the Ben Corman house in my memories. Lots of memories with that house.
Did you like that house, Nancy?
I loved it. It was a beautiful location. On the south end, there were 27 acres of just rural pastoral views. Lots of good memories. One thing I sometimes did, which I almost forgot about, was... For 3 years during that time when I was renting that house 9 months out of the year, there was a neighbor, Leslie McDonald, who lived on Cape St. Mary Road. She would go up during the summer to Alaska to work in the fish canneries. So she would move out of her house. I would move out of Steve Young's house and move into her house. And then Steve Young would come up from California and move into, the Ben Corman or his house. And we did that for 3 years until Leslie stopped going up to Alaska. So that was 3 years where I stayed.
Musical houses on the south end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then 1 year I didn't have a place in the summer, and Uncle Phil Haston said, Nancy, they've just moved 90-year-old Marty Walczak out of his cabin on Islanddale Road. You could probably rent that for... $25 a month. And I said, it's a deal, sight unseen. I was desperate, no place to live again. And so I went over and looked at it. It was a two-room little building. I'd never met Marty Walczak. I guess he was a retired longshoreman on the island that had retired to the island. And he used to drive a 1930 or 1931 Model A pickup. I used to see the pickup driving around, but I had never met him. But they had taken him to the mainland, to some old people's home or some place, because he was getting too old to live alone. And so I went there, and it was a two-room house. No one had packed up his belongings, so every chair had about 7 layers of clothing hanging on it. All his stuff was everywhere. There was sort of this bachelor slime on the kitchen cabinets around the handle, the knobs. There was just a cold running water tap again, and the drain, which was just a hose going out into the yard, had been plugged, I think, for years and wouldn't drain. My dad came after I moved in and spent an entire day working with snakes to open up that drain. He was finally able to do it. I later found out that Marion Wise had, in trying to help Marty, had somebody work on that drain too, and they had been unsuccessful. But anyway, it was, I painted the entire interior, packed up all his belongings and boxed them up and put them in the well house. They're probably still there. And he had a amazing, he was right on the waterfront. He was on the west side of Island Day or Mud Bay, just north of Dr. Kinslow's place. And it had a terrific clam beach. Clams would almost literally jump in your bucket. He hadn't dug clams, he'd been too old. I remember several times actually digging clams by kerosene lantern at night. And it was just really a neat place. The water view had been obstructed because he had let all the young trees grow up. Mm-hmm. And so I trimmed a few of them and removed a few of them so I'd have a little bit more of a water view. It also came with a collapsed outhouse.
A collapsed?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I ever really found the site of the outhouse. It had been collapsed so long ago. But there was no phone line available at the time. And this was prior to the arrival of cell phones in the 80s. And so I had just left a really stormy marriage and so decided to give up this rental at the end of summer because I and move back to the 9-month rental. Even, you know, I really hated giving up those clams, but I just felt I really needed a phone because there were no neighbors around or that I could run to and ask for help or mm-hmm. just absentee neighbors. So I ended up moving back to the 9-month rental.
Steve Young's place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Steve Young is living there now full time.
All right.
He's made quite a lot of improvements. another place I lived, for 1 year I had free rent in exchange for caring for two dogs. Bob and Odile Buchanan, who used to live on crossroads between Center and Fisherman Bay Roads on the south side, he taught landscape architecture at the UW, and they were taking a year sabbatical in Rome, and they didn't want to leave their dogs in a kennel or in the city, so they had this summer place. So they word got out that they were willing to give a year's free rent if I took care, or whoever would take care of their two dogs. So I had an old the only thing I got out of my broken marriage was this reject dog of my late husband's. And it was one of these dogs that didn't like other dogs and would like fight to the death.
Oh, no.
And so I had this dog that didn't like other dogs. And so I had to keep my dog
separate
from their dogs for the whole year.
Oh my.
Which was, they had a guest house, so every time my dog was an indoor dog, theirs were outdoor dogs, so every time my dog needed to go out, I just put their dogs in the guest house for about 5 minutes, let my dog out, and put my dog back in. We only had one time where I slipped up and we had a big rumble. And
that would be kind of an anxiety producing experience for me, I think.
Yeah. But it worked out, you know, it was free rent.
Mm-hmm.
I could put up with it.
You didn't have to look for summer.
No, I wasn't homeless during the summer. It was great.
Nancy, you were the queen of gypsy housing is what you were.
Yeah, I was. And then I had an opportunity to caretake 75 acres of waterfront for adjacent to Point Colville, just west of Point Colville. And so I had a reduced rent the couple were actually built a building with a caretaker's apartment in it. And so I lived there for about 8 years. And that was wonderful, living right next to Point Colville and being close to the water. I Wattmouth Head Peninsula was mine. Just walked everywhere. It was really wonderful. And then, back in the late 80s, the Land Trust started organizing, and I became involved with them. And we had meeting after meeting, planning, housing. And so I was part of the first Land Trust housing. I think I deserved it after all I went through for housing. And it's sort of what they call sweat equity, mm-hmm. where you build your own house. And so we were required to put in so many hours per week while we built the houses. They took 7 months to build. And my father was a retired electrician, and so he came over to Lopez every week for those 7 months and lived with me 4 days a week. And we wired all seven houses that were built. Or actually, there were eight buildings that were built. We wired all the buildings. I got to pull a lot of wire under all the buildings since you know, I was just the, what are they called? There's the journeyman and then the one underneath, the trainee.
The apprentice.
I was the apprentice.
And this is at Morgantown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I still live there. So I've been there for over, 18, 19 years now.
Mm.
And what was really funny was, you know, my dad would stay with me out near Point Colville at where I was living at the time while I was building the house. And when he first came, he was a cigar smoker. And so, you know, he brought his stuff in and started lighting up this big stogie. And I said, "Dad, if you're going to smoke your cigar, you got to smoke out on the deck." And he said, "Listen, do you want your house built, wired or not?" And I said, "Make yourself at home." And so he smoked in my house the whole time. Well, I grew up with him smoking cigars, so I was pretty used to it. But so anyway, he...
What a trade.
"I'm the dad. You're the kid. Remember that." So that's sort of my housing history on Lopez. You know, I love the stability of the land trust and what they've provided for me and for my neighborhood. And I so appreciate the opportunity to be involved with a group. I really think that they really have served the island well.
Mm-hmm. And now how many we have?
Four.
Four land trust housing.
Groups.
Groups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, I remember a time that you lived, well, I'm vague about it, but when you go to Watmouth Beach, and right at the beginning, you lived somewhere at that corner.
Well, that would, well, right where you turn off for Watmouth Beach, that was the Point Colville property.
Oh, that was
the building they built, we called the barn, the owners of the 75 acres of waterfront. They built the caretaker's building or apartment in this, what they called the barn, right at the beginning of their property.
Right.
So my job description was troll. If somebody thought they might trespass, I would kind of come out from under the bridge and bark a little bit and say, "Do you realize this is private property?"
But no wonder I remember, because you lived there for 8 years.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And that I remember.
Now, that would make an interesting business card. Nancy McCoy.
Troll.
Love it.
Yeah, a little picture with it.
Yeah. But you've had some other interesting jobs on this island.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe you could fill us in on that, Nancy.
Well, I came to the island, you know, clueless, and really had no plan.
A city girl.
Yeah.
Degree in what?
I had a teaching degree in art. I graduated about 1970 from Seattle Pacific. And at that time, there was a glut on the market. Teachers were a glut on the market. I mean, I filled out and more teaching applications, and there were just no jobs available. And so I, in Seattle for 5 years, was a full-time art teacher, substitute teacher. I substitute taught art in middle school and high school in Seattle, Seattle, Shoreline, and Kent School Districts. You know, they'd call me in the morning, I'd go wherever they sent me.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
I later did that too on Lopez, but I, for the school district, but I taught K through 12 in anything. because, you know, of limited opportunities. So, one of the first jobs that I ended up performing was at a herring plant on Fisherman Bay Peninsula. It was on the east side of Fisherman Bay Peninsula. I believe the building was converted to a ranch-style house later on. And basically, we packed herring for bait in little styrofoam trays, you know, kind of sized them up. And it was a pretty small operation, maybe a half a dozen women packing fish all at once together. And the fish were caught by a wood purse seiner, the Albany, which was owned by a Friday Harbor family, I believe the Crosbys. I went out one night with them. They fished, it was a seiner, and they fished at night. Mm. And I loved fishing. And I'm really glad that I was able to go out with them one night and see how they did it. And then they'd bring their fish up over to a pen, I believe, on Shoal Bay, sort of where the marina is now. And Larry Cochran would, I think, electrocute them. And then that was his job. And then he would transport the fish to the peninsula. And I remember having a big brouhaha with Larry because why do only guys get to electrocute the fish? Why can't girls electrocute the fish?
Nancy, do you have any idea how that happened? How do you, you know, take them one by one? What do you do?
No, I think you just stick something in the water, the pin in the water or something like that. I'm not sure. But, you know,
wanted to be a fish electrocutor.
Well, I just wanted to make more money, too. And to get out of that hair, that line of packing lines. So, but another thing that I did for a living was, it must have been in the springtime or early summer, I hung cork line for Will Olander, who used to live on Pavey Hill. And Will was this gill netter who started out fishing in the islands here. And he, it was just right during the Judge Bolt decision, and he was arrested, I think, for fishing illegally. You know, they had certain days that white people could fish and certain days, Indian days, that could be fished. And he
did not observe the days.
No, he did not observe the days and was busted. You know, people boarded his boat.
Oh.
And he... I don't know if he went to jail or not, but he went on trial in front of Judge Bolt.
Mm.
And there was, I think, some write-ups in the Journal newspaper in the early 80s about that. But Will was a delightful person. He, you know, loved Baroque music. He played the harpsichord. And he had these big, swollen fisherman's hands.
Mm.
And I just... love being around him. But he paid me, I believe, for hanging cork line, which is basically you'd have the mesh of the web of the gill net, and then you'd attach a thicker line on the top edge of the web, and every so many inches you would attach a cork. There used to be wooden float corks, and then they later turned to styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
And you would use a net bench, which was basically a little, usually a plywood little bench that you would straddle, and you'd pull the cork line one way and, you know, hook a line on it. And there were certain little nails that would show you the measurement, you know, because they had to be precise of how the distance and so forth. And then you had to tie certain knots and around the front and the back of the cork.
So he taught you how to do it?
He taught me how to do it, had the net bench. And then later you would also hang what was called a lead line. And that would go on the other side of the web. And there used to be external cork lead lines where they'd attach pieces of lead that kind of slipped over the line or were attached somehow. But when I was doing this, they actually had lead line that the lead was incorporated into the line itself by the manufacturer. But Wilbur paid me for hanging his cork line in Baroque music, dark chocolate, and very strong coffee. He'd have this big thermos of coffee sitting next to my net bench. And there used to be a program on, I don't know if it was King FM or what, but called Basically Baroque in the morning. And you hear, you know, playing J.S. Bach and, you know, just, you know, working as fast as you can because that music would, you know, set the tempo. It was great.
Did you like that kind of handwork, Nancy?
Oh, I like. Yes, I enjoyed it. I love being around Will, and I love being outdoors. And you know, it was you know, I could be by myself and think of what I wanted to think. And
you got paid in dark chocolate,
Baroque music, and very strong coffee. He might have paid me. I don't know if he would have had.
Maybe he added a $5 bill every so often.
I don't know. I can't remember. It was so long ago.
And this was not a 40-hour week job.
No, it was, no. You know, just get the...
Now and again.
Get the net hung, get it hung before the season
all
opens.
All right, okay.
Or the cork line hung, or attached before the season opens.
Oh, my goodness.
About that time, too, I met my... my one and only husband that I was briefly married to, and he convinced me to invest in a wood fishing boat, gillnet boat, so that we could fish. And so we bought Homer Evans' old boat, the Chris E, and Homer had not really, he was in his 80s and hadn't really fished hard, and so he... So, you know, we started modifying the boat and fishing it more. And as the season opened, we started realizing that the boat was had some serious things that needed to be looked at, like it should have been recorked. And, you know, a lot of the, what do they call it, the electrical systems were should have been redone. You know, at that time, they had CD radios on board the fishing boats to communicate.
Oh.
And because there were no cells or whatever. So they were all, copy that, you know, all the CD stuff, lingo. And so, and at that time, I think we were homeless again. So we were living in that boat during the summer, too, for a while. And that boat was not set up for living. So we were just, you know, down... On the inside was an open, exposed, old gasoline engine, and, you know, with a kind of a V berth around it, and that's where we lived, camped out at the dock at what's used to be known as Bumblebee Dock, which is now Salmon Point, and that's where all the fishermen lived or worked out of us down there at Salmon Point. And when we were down there...
Bumblebee Dock sounds better, don't you think?
Doesn't it, though? Yeah. And that's the brand, that was the company that...
Yeah, it started out, it was the base for, years ago, John Troxell used that as a base for the fish trap industry.
Oh.
And so there was a big, it was the base for, you know, tarring nets and... wiring nets and all sorts of things back until fish traps were outlawed in 1934. And then later they started using it for the gill netting industry that came up, you know, after the fish traps were barred. And a little bit, sometimes seiners would anchor in McKay Harbor too. But when I was there in, sort of 76, we just fished one summer in 76. I remember Bustin Jevic, who was who owned the Sally J that's at the Lopez Museum, and Bustin Jevic was the what they called the highliner of the Lopez fleet. He caught the most fish usually, and he always fished off the iceberg marker. That was his spot, and if you got in his spot, he'd let you know. And he didn't want you to cork him. You know, if you, like, your boat crossed, you know, there's a term called corking you know, somebody else's nets or what, you know, I'm just, anyway, if you got too close or your nets crossed over his, you know, they got corked and.
What did he do?
Oh, he'd get upset. So you just stayed away from Bastrojevic and his spot. And then there was Nell's flat. And I just remember him walking down the dock. He always had his shoes untied. And I was always, he was an older man. And a lot of these fishermen at Lopez were older men because I think anybody with any get up and go would head north to Bristol Bay or Dutch Harbor and fish. So Nels Blad always, you know, I was always sure he was going to fall, trip on his shoestrings and fall overboard off the dock, but he never, no, I never saw him. Also, there was Bill and Paul Troxel, two brothers. Mm-hmm. They had another brother that had quite an interesting incident occur during, I think it was fish trap days. Let's see if I can remember it. Lincoln Weeks told me the story. Lincoln was in his 90s in the 80s. But this one brother, I think it was a Troxel. I don't know if it was that generation or the one above. But somehow or other, he was fastening something, tying something with the fish traps on. They drive these big pilings into the water and attach all this kind of chicken wire, kind of a maze that the salmon would fish into, or swim into and get caught. But anyway, somehow or other, something broke loose or something and got this Troxel brother in the chest or something. Anyway, there was this big wound and he was just bleeding profusely. So I think it was Lincoln and someone else. This was up in Blaine. They had a trap up near Blaine somewhere. So they put him in the boat. And Lincoln told me he took a screwdriver and jammed it into the, I don't know, the throttle so it was wide open on this boat to get this guy to the Blaine hospital. So they went into Blaine. There was nobody there that could care for him. So they put him back in the boat or whatever and jammed the screwdriver back into the throttle as, you know, so that it was wide open again and went to Bellingham. But then at that time, they didn't know anything. He needed a transfusion because he lost so much blood. And so at that time, they didn't know about different blood types. And so they, you know, would just transfer blood from one donor to another. And I think he got the wrong blood type. And so he didn't survive. And then one of the other brothers, you know, he had left a widow with small children. So one of the late fisherman's brothers married the widow and raised the children as his own.
Raised his nephews and nieces as his own children. Mm-hmm. And this is the Troxel family.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it left quite an impression on me. And I believe that I interviewed Lincoln Weeks at the museum, and it's on, you know, tape, cassette tape.
I remember
tape.
Lincoln Weeks. He used to deliver stuff.
That was his brother. Started with an E, his first name. His brother, I don't know if it was
Not
younger
Lincoln,
brother.
Huh?
No, Lincoln was a dairy farmer who had the old Hodemacher farm or the Davis Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And but his brother, who lived up in a little cottage on the property just north of the village at Portside, there's now a double wide called Portside. That's where this other brother's name started with an started with an E, his first name. I can't think of it at the moment. I'll think of it tonight after I go to bed.
He did deliveries?
He did sort of UPS deliveries.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Wasn't Elmer.
Weeks. No.
And he was old, you know.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he loved to talk.
Yeah.
You know, he'd deliver something and then just start talking and not never leave.
Well, how did you like having a fishing boat and being a fisher person?
I love fishing, but working with my husband was another thing because, you know, if we got in a jam, he would kind of go crazy and start yelling and screaming and I didn't enjoy that part of it. But
after you divorced him, did you keep the boat?
No, we had gotten rid of it. I remember one night going out fishing, and we had, left McKay Harbor and passed Iceberg, and we got in the middle of a pod of
Elton.
Not Elton, close. It's not Elton, but close. But anyway, we got in the middle of a pod of about 20 to 21 orcas.
Oh.
Swimming in the same, traveling in the same direction.
Oh.
You know, we're all after the same thing, salmon.
Oh, right.
And so, you know, we just shut down our engine and just floated among the orcas. And that was a real highlight.
Of course, yeah.
Another memory was my husband decided one night that I needed to prove myself as a fisher person. So he sent me out alone one night with, an 18-year-old kid to kind of help a little bit. So we went out, and the boat really had a lot of problems. And so we got out there, and we had put out our net, and we were sort of off Davidson Reef, off Point Colville. And the electrical system totally went out. So we didn't have any CB radio. We didn't have any bailer, nothing. And the boat started taking on water. And so I spent the whole night with a galvanized gallon bucket bailing the whole night. Because we fished at night because we had fishing regulations mandated. We had kind of a nylon net that was visible to salmon, so we fished at night where the Indians had a plastic net that was clear and they could fish during the day. So we were fishing at night, and I just remember just bailing all night and no way to call for help because the CD radio was out as well. And then just at dawn, we're sort of drifting into the freighter lanes too, just drifting. And we had pulled the net in, and we did catch 30. We had to pull the net in by hand too, which was a big project because we had the net out. So we pulled it in by hand and did catch 36 fish, which was good. But just at dawn, Will Olander came cruising by with his gill netter. Came over. It looked kind of like we had a lot of fish in the hold because we were so low down in the water. And he says he attached a rope or something to the boat and pulled us back to McKay Harbor, and we survived. So I think of Will fondly after that event.
Oh, my gosh.
So, he's really saved our lives.
Yeah. Sounds like a very scary night. You're not telling it as if it was a very scary night, Nancy.
Well, it was a few years ago.
It has
I was too busy to be scared.
Bailing
bucket after bucket,
But your engines quit or wouldn't?
That went out too. So, just the whole thing quit. We couldn't operate things.
But you got 30-some salmon that night.
36, yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah. So that was, I really loved fishing. I went out with other people fishing on other boats and, that were a little more mellow, and I love fishing. So those were sort of my early jobs on Lopez, and then I fell into a job with the Lopez Historical Museum. I began volunteering. I think it was at one of their auctions when I first, in the late 70s, when I started, I volunteered one year at their auction. They used to hold them outdoors, right outside on the museum grounds. They had kind of a little platform set up, and people would just bring stuff the day of the auction, and then somebody would... There was no organization really or anything. They just had a couple of volunteer auctioneers, and somebody would say, point to something and say, put that up for bid. And so the auctioneer would grab it and sell it for a quarter or They didn't make much money either, but they had been doing it for years at Odland Park and so forth. And so I ended up chairing their auction for 22 years. And that was really, I loved it. It was like a week out of, well, the auction setup was a week setup after I got organizing it a bit. But I mean, I remember breaking up fist fights during just before the auction with two of our volunteers. We had one volunteer named Harland Eastwood.
Oh, I remember Harland.
He was a one-armed man. He had lost his arm.
He was in my writing class.
Yeah. He was a one-armed man. He had lost his arm in a football game, I think, at high school, when he was in high school. But he was a really amazing individual. Difficult to get along with, but amazing. Like, he would mountain climb and do mountain rescue with one arm. And
he married Esther Carhart?
Yes. And his first wife, they honeymooned in a fire lookout up at Mount, you know, like near Darrington somewhere, in a fire lookout.
He wrote a book about that.
Yeah, he wrote a book. It's something about Goat Mountain or something. Yeah. It's at our library, or was at our library. It's a little rough, the book, but very interesting. Very interesting man. But anyway, he was a very stubborn man. He often would drive my other volunteers away because they couldn't deal with him. But he and Phil Hastings, the morning of one of my auctions, got in almost a fist fight because we had posted some, you know, entrance signs and exit only signs on the old Woodman Hall. And, you know, volunteers setting up, I didn't really expect them to adhere to those signs. But one of them was determined the other person wasn't supposed to exit if the sign read no exit. And so they were just ready to, I don't think they really liked each other anyway, but they were just ready to slug it out. And so I had to, look at you guys, just relax, you know, we're trying to put an auction on here.
Oh.
Another time I had, we used to have a bar at our auctions because the old theory was that you liquor somebody up, bitters up a little bit, they're a little looser with their change, and so I cut that out fairly soon after I started. But our auctioneers, we'd usually have several auctioneers, one of our auctioneers, I didn't realize it at the time, would, between his stints on the podium, would drink. And so for some reason or other, he got up, this one auctioneer got upset and took off, got upset right in the middle of the auction and was going to walk out and leave us empty-handed with no auctioneer. And so I had to kind of run after him and smooth his feathers and try to beg him to come back. And so I was able to bring him back and we finished the auction.
Maybe a little less successful than it would have been. But
Yes. But so I started volunteering, and then I actually wrote a grant to fund a position, because there were islanders, two of which were Gertrude Lovejoy Bodie and Eva Higgins, who were charter members of the organization. They, first of all, said, Nancy, we've heard about this museum training workshop in Laconer, at the Laconer Museum, and if we paid your tuition to attend this workshop for a week, would you do some volunteer work for us? And I said, oh, that sounds like a great deal. And so I went to Laconer for a week, and, you know, they didn't pay for my accommodation. So I had a little pup tent and stayed out at the Pioneer Park by the Rainbow Bridge for a week in my little pup tent and attended this workshop for a week and sort of learned some of the rudimentary parts,
basics
of museum accessioning and registry and stuff. And then, so I started volunteering, and then I heard about a CETA grant that was available to pay for training, on-the-job training. And so we got this grant for 18 months to pay my salary for working at the museum while the museum was just getting, it hadn't opened yet. And so there was just, they had the volunteers, the charter members had built a building, but they had the interior wasn't really set up yet. They had a pile of stuff in the middle of the floor of donations with no notes as to where they came from, what they meant. And that was what I began with. And so I started, you know, investigating what those things were and who donated them.
How old they were, mm-hmm. where they came from.
Yeah, there was none of that there. So we did that and set up the museum in those 18 months. And then at the end of the 18 months, we're running out of time. At the end of the 18 months, you know, I was thinking, oh dear, my grant runs out, and they're either going to have to apply for another grant and hire somebody else or something. But then I was never a fan of Ronald Reagan until this. He decided to eliminate CETA grants, and so there, you know, they couldn't apply for another grant and hire someone else. And so it ran out, and the board had a meeting about what are we going to do now. We don't have any money to pay for her salary. So they had several huddles and meetings, and I think being sent outside, I think it was during a board meeting or something. And so, and then they finally came out and said, Nancy, come in here. And so I went back in. They said, Nancy, would you consider working for the museum at $100 a month? And I said, that sounds great. And I was only paying $1 a day rent at the time. So that was only a third of my monthly income.
Goodness, Nancy.
And so so that's how I started working at the Historical Museum. And I worked at the museum for 24 years and loved every moment of it. I loved meeting the people, loved working with my two mentors, Gertrude Bode.
I remember Gertrude Bode. She used to give shows of
slideshows
at the Grange. Mm-hmm. And when we came in the summer in the 70s, we would go, the kids too, all of us would go and learn more about Lopez.
These are slides. Was she a born and raised Lopezian?
Yeah.
How did she have this background?
Her parents owned the Richardson store in 1900, and she grew up working in the store.
Hey.
And so then later they sold the business, but they retained, they also owned a cannery out on what's now Davis Head development. Right, there's kind of a cement pad where their docks are,
mm-hmm.
and there was a large cannery that her family built, they would bring in Chinese laborers during the summer to work there to can with lead solder and so forth the salmon that were brought in by the fishermen. Mm-hmm. And so they retained property from like Davis Head to the store, or quite a bit of it, for their own. And they had a house there, and or several houses over the years.
And so she would do these slideshows and tell about her childhood days.
Yeah.
What was it like, Allie?
She would tell about, you know, she would show different pictures of Lopez and tell the story behind it, like a house or mm-hmm. or a
she,
property or
yeah. She was always interested in preserving the history. And so what she would do is borrow, you know, before we had digital cameras, she would borrow people's family photographs, copy them, and make a slide from them,
yeah.
and then return the original. And then she would document, she used 4x6 card index cards, and she would document, write everything she'd get assigned each image a number, and then she would put that number on her card, and she would write as much information as she could about that particular image. And so she was really good at recording this, you know, as a volunteer. And she had been married twice. I'm not quite sure when she met her second husband. She was first married to Lowell Lovejoy. She was a Graham originally. And she married Lowell Lovejoy, who was, I think, a shoemaker for a while in Friday Harbor. And then he passed away. And then years later, she went to a countywide Grange meeting, which they call Pomona Grange, when all the local island Granges come together. And she met this man, Eckert Bodie, from Orcas at the Pomona Grange meeting.
Yeah.
And they fell in love. And he moved his single wide over to her property and her house and attached it to her house. You know, they got married first. And
all proper.
Yes. And he would do all the cooking and housekeeping while she was organizing her photos and her slides. She had this gorgeous big picture window overlooking Richardson Bay. And she'd just be sitting there all day cataloging, recording and making notes, and Eckert be cooking and cleaning. And she says, you know, she told me once, I thought I was happy with Lowell, but oh, Eckert. And she kind of clasped
her hands together.
Yeah. Oh, Eckert.
So I'm assuming that was a gold mine for you as the director of the museum to have somebody with all this.
Yes.
Memory and willingness to catalog everything.
Yes, and then also there was Lincoln Weeks, who was just this 90-year-old man who had the amazing memory. And then Eva Higgins, who also collected history. She grew up at Richardson as well, and her family home, she was a Weir, which is over by where Pat Rowe used to live, and now it's across from, I guess it's near the Burt Road and Davis Road intersection. But her husband, late husband, Owen, and she lived at his family place just east of Richardson, where that big gray gambrel roof barn is that mm-hmm. was just re-roofed. Mm-hmm. That was their place. And I understand their house was built from a kit, like they had, you know, a whole bunch of lumber had been brought in to assemble a house, and then they had just a left over for an extra little building.
Yep. Well, Nancy, we've only got about two more minutes, and well, for one thing, I'm wondering if you'll come back, because I'm very sure you've got more old-time stories that you might be willing to tell.
Maybe. I might.
Oh, goodness. Well, what a day-to-day, telling us from everything, from your employment as a troll to herring packer, didn't get to be the herring electrocutor, and hanging cork line, and getting paid with chocolate, Baroque music and coffee,
gillnet fisher person.
Yeah, a lot of fun stories.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
It was my pleasure.
We've come to the end of our Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. Thank you for listening.
This show was pre-recorded.